Welcome to our podcast on preparing for the African century. This podcast is brought to you by the International Academy for Leadership, known by its German acronym IAF. Well, it's located in the German town of Gummersbach. The Academy brings together leaders working for partner organizations of the Frederick Norman Foundation for Freedom from all over the world. It brings together experts, opinion leaders, and very, very committed young liberals and aspiring leaders to share very specific experiences and knowledge and to develop liberal solutions to public policy challenges. And today's discussion is centered around preparing for the African century. As we know that Africa has grown in terms of its population, and we're expecting a population explosion in Africa, we really wanted to explore this further in terms of whether this is an opportunity or a challenge. And whenever we talk about the African development paradigm, it's always comes up with two things in common. One is the geopolitics and how it influences in the African continent. And the second part is how foreign aid has intervened. But we rarely talk about investment opportunities, of how things are moving, which sectors are growing in Africa. Today, we want to delve in all these topics a little bit deeper. In order to do so, we have a wonderful guest with us. Let me introduce you to our guest. We have with us Ibrahim Babatunde Anoba, who is the editor of African Liberty, the continent's premier media organization that works to advance individual freedoms and government accountability. He's an African philosophical history columnist for the Cato Institute's libertarianism.org project, and he works with think tanks in Africa on identifying sustainable policies to facilitate Africa's economic prosperity. His policy work has been cited in reports by advocacy groups, including Transparency International, Oxfam, and the Acton Institute. His commentaries and opinion articles have also been featured in medias such as the Forbes, ABC, Al Jazeera, Mail and the Guardian, Business Insider, The African Report, National Interest, Real Clear World, and several others. So Babatunde, thank you very much for accepting our invitation and sitting us for this very, very interesting conversation about Africa. Welcome to the podcast.
Thank you for having me, Abita.
Thank you. So let's start off with the discussion in this fascinating article that you've written, and you point out Africa's population growth, right? So you start off by saying that by 2050s, Africa's population will increase to an unprecedented 2.4 billion, eventually to a staggering 4.2 billion by 2100, right? So to us, that's crazy numbers right there. There was a point of time in development that everybody thought like massive population growth is a problem. The attitudes have shifted slightly in terms of saying like, no, population is a resource, it's an opportunity. So how do you see Africa's population growth, particularly from that perspective? Do you see it larger as an opportunity? Is this a growth opportunity for Africa to play a more prominent role in global politics, global trade? Or do you see that there are certainly a lot of challenges that probably Africa is not equipped to control at the moment? So how do you see that overall?
Yeah, I mean, so it's a pleasure to be on the podcast. You know, we're recording this in New Delhi, right? And you see everywhere that one of the key things in the minds of the Indian government is to maximize the population, the strength of the population to facilitate economic development. And China has also shown that population doesn't have to be a problem. So it's a matter of looking at how people or countries have done it in the past, China, now recently India, and looking what into Africa and how we can also maximize that. And you already mentioned it, about 2.5 billion population figure will be the reality of the continent by 2050. I mean, 2050 is not too far away. This is 2024. Yeah, how many more years? 26 years? So that's pretty soon. And if that is our reality in the next 2+ decades, the one thing you then have to look at is the readiness of the continent. I was saying a couple of days ago to somebody that the continent's infrastructure deficit, it's somewhere in between the region of $130 to $170 billion. That's according to African Development Bank. Because you can't talk about economic development or population benefit without infrastructure, right? So if our infrastructure deficit is about $170 billion, then the question we need to ask is, where do we need to find that money to invest in infrastructure so that by the time we are actually calling for foreign direct investment or trying to have our local entrepreneurs create more business opportunities, they will need infrastructure. So if the infrastructure is not ready, you pretty much are deceiving yourself. You drive around this region of India, and I drove through New Delhi to Uttar Pradesh, around Uttar Pradesh yesterday, and it's the one thing that keep occurring to me is just the impeccableness of the infrastructure. I mean, that probably is one part of India that I'm seeing, but what I've seen so far, it's immense intentional infrastructure layout that connects different rural parts of India to capital, economic capitals like New Delhi. And that's one of the wanting factors you will find in any African city. But so if our reality is 2.5 billion, just to give you a context. So in 1900, our population was just around 140 million people, right? And it has grown tenfold ever since. So 140 million to 2.5 billion in the space of 150 years, that is immense. So it's a matter of looking at countries like Nigeria. That will be Nigeria is going to be like the third most populous country after India and China by 2050. And you look at how that country is ready. The business corridor is not encouraging. Inflation is skyrocketing. Infrastructure is almost nowhere. Poverty is ravaging. Nigeria is largely the poverty capital of the world. And several African countries are not too far from Nigeria. So I don't want to sound gloomy and negative, but our reality is very much dire. And it's not so encouraging to see the attitude of several of our governments, with the exception of countries like Mauritius and Botswana and whatnot. But majority of the big powers on the country, Nigeria, Ghana, South Africa, Kenya, it's not too much of an encouragement. But I hope that changes soon.
We see some of the projections of population growth that are kind of mind-blowing. I mean, it looks as if Africa, within the next maybe 50, 70 years, might reach almost the same population levels as Asia has. So we are looking at massive growth of population. And that can either, as you say, be a huge asset if handled well, like what you said, India and China, but it can also, of course, be a huge dilemma, if not a catastrophe, if it is not handled well. So every country tries to, and Africa, on top of this, is a very young continent. I mean, a lot of people are below the age of 25. So many countries see this as a dividend, as a demographic dividend. But how do we really make it an asset? I mean, what is necessary in Africa? You mentioned infrastructure, and when you said 170 billion, I think what you meant is per year even, right? So this is not just one lump sum. This is consistent investment. But are there other factors? How do we get this demographic dividend to really become an asset?
Yeah, I mean, you already put it right. Majority of the people in the continent right now are young people. And that projection of 2.5 billion by 2050 will still be heavily young. And the funny thing with young people, as you've seen recently, is that when you talk about people have said there is no migration crisis. I mean, debate it to whatever extent you want to. But you look at the huge chunk of people living in the continent that are trying every means to get out. These are heavily young people. You hardly find someone who is like beyond 65 among any kind of migratory report by International, Transparency International, Amnesty International. They are heavily young people. So if that's the case, and it's going to get much more worse by 2050 if we do not ready the continent, that it's one thing to worry about. But the other thing, which is kind of positive, is that young people on the continent are actually not waiting for the government anymore to facilitate development. I was also mentioning a couple of days ago that one of the brightest side of Africa in terms of news these days is the fintech sector. And our fintech sector is driven by young people who are creating apps and transactional platforms for people to facilitate trade. I was saying I was in Nigeria for a couple of months, and I was just amazed. You can pretty much buy corn on the street of Lagos pretty much by using digital payments, and many of those things are you couldn't imagine them 2010, even like 6 years ago. They were pretty much non-occurring, and the fintech sector on the continent is huge. Over 1,000 of them exist now, and roughly about half of those fintech companies were created in the last 6 years. And since 2000, last 24 years, they've collectively raised about $6 billion in equity. So those are bright facts to look at. But the other thing is, which I find so interesting, is you also look at the political part, because if we talk the economics all this while, but the politics is also contingent upon, economics is contingent upon political stability, right? You look at the conversation about accountability, constitutionalism, rule of law, democracy in Africa in the last, let's not even go far, in the last 2 years, they've been driven by young people. I recently wrote a piece for Real Clear, and it was about this massive protest movement in Kenya, Nigeria, in the last one month, just last month. In July and August, we had massive protests across Kenya. What was the reason why they were protesting? Because the government initiated a new tax regime. And the young people weren't having it. The older people, I mean, they were part of the protest, but the young people were on the street. It was a massive, massive political crisis in Kenya. The same thing happened in Nigeria, where young people were actually rejecting many of the government's reform, asking for more transparency, right? So you look at the economic part, young people are actually driving the digitalization, fintech industry. And in the politics side of things, they might not be contesting election as president, because they wouldn't get into politics and win elections, except for one or two instances like you have in Senegal, when there is the new president, a very young man. But majority of the conversation about politics and the continent from young people is about resistance, resisting crazy tax regime, resisting lack of accountability and whatnot. So you see all these positives and you want to feel kind of hopeful that things might get better.
That's a very positive thing. So just in terms of preparedness of the African continent, with large populations or with population growth, we have to think about food security. We have to think about how do we service a population that is young in terms of health services or education services and so on and so forth, right? But at the same time, I feel like Africa has been sort of carrying the burden of conservation quite a lot in the environmental front as well. So sure, it's a huge continent. How do you see the preparedness of African countries? Are there examples of specific countries that have done very well in this? Or, are there hopeful stories like the democracy movement that you said, like, you know, people are demanding more transparency? Are there positive, hopeful stories such as that coming out of Africa that gives you a lot of hope?
Yeah, I mean, there are several of them. You just need to look at the Economic Freedom Index in the last how many years, 5 years, and you keep seeing Mauritius and Botswana coming up as two of the most economically free of the continent. And you have newer countries like Cote d'Ivoire coming on the rank. I mean, countries where you wouldn't even see or imagine economic freedom, because several of those countries are under some kind of militant rule. Cote d'Ivoire is ruled by someone who has been powerful, God knows when. And so it's kind of complicated in that way. But you also have to think about what makes a country ready for maximizing the potential of a large population or globalization. Healthcare, as you mentioned. I saw some days ago that I think 20 or 22% of people that is sick from one disease or another on the continent, 22%. And if that is the case, then it means Africa should be spending heavily on healthcare. But that's not the case. Less than 1% of the global investment in healthcare is on the continent. So there's a massive gap there. And there's no way you can invite IBM, Microsoft, or all those big corporations to come to your country and invest if the healthcare is not there. The young people that we are calling on is going to be the bastion of prosperity. If the education and healthcare are not good enough for them, then it's going to be a challenge. So again, look at India and China. Those are some of the things they emphasize towards their development track. So again, there are positives on the continent. Mauritius, Botswana. And I don't like to make the reference, but you just have to face the reality. Rwanda is one of the positive in terms of stability and positive stability generally. But you have to remember, countries like Rwanda are under what many have called undemocratic regimes, because the president has been in power for a long time, And that further complicates the conversation about democracy in Africa. Do you need the government to change hands in every 4 years or 5 years for you to have economic progress? You just have to look at Rwanda, and that might be a complicated debate. But anyway, the point here is that there are positives on the continent and countries that you might even look at as the older folks or countries that we've looked at in the last 10, 20 years as samples of progress, like South Africa, Ghana, and Kenya. They are having tremendous challenges these days. Inflation in those countries are insane. So again, positives, but we can only hope for more positives.
And is this success case is largely due to stability, or are there also some inspired policies that were created in Botswana or in Mauritius or any other country?
Yeah, so it's normally one of the interesting things is we say for you to have economic prosperity, you must have democratic government to a large extent. That conversation is a little bit challenging when you look at countries like Mauritius, because Mauritius, I don't even want to pronounce the name of Mauritius, it's a ruling party. You just have to look at that yourself. It's in English, but it's an interesting thing. And you look at the name of the ruling party in Mauritius, or one of the ruling parties in the last 10 years, and you wouldn't even consider Mauritius to be one of the countries that will have economic freedom or open market like that. And it's just contrary to what the government stands for. But the point here is that I think several of our leaders on the continent, not many, but several of them actually seeing they're now opening themselves to the fact that no matter how your political agenda is, I don't care how many insane authoritarian intentions you might have, they've realized that you cannot grow without foreign direct investment. You cannot grow without encouraging a local entrepreneur. You cannot grow if you are imposing untenable tariffs across your borders, or your border is pretty much closed. Even the most authoritarian regimes, Rwanda, Mauritius, sometimes they are some of the, I hate to say it, but some of the freest economies on the continent. Maybe not so strong one, but Mauritius certainly. So, I guess it's a question of, regardless of whatever political circumstance exists in a country, military junta, or democratic regime, or authoritarian regime, we are seeing that open trade, open market, less regulations on local entrepreneurs, and the encouragement of competition is actually driving progress.
But just a question, which is looking at examples from the rest of the world. So we can take, economically free places like Singapore as an example, and say, well, exactly, it's one government or, a strongman leader. So do you see, for example, in examples in Africa where places which have economic freedom are slowly also moving towards more democratization? Or is the perception in Africa that democracy is a very messy process and does not really deliver in terms of economic freedom or like what we want, and therefore we need a benevolent dictator sort of a person to come into power and tell us all what to do? So what's the perception, larger perception in Africa?
So you're very correct. What you said, democracy in Africa is messy. I wouldn't even say super messy, because you look at how you define a stable government: periodic elections, constitutional rule, respect for legislation or legislative arm of government. And it's not in every African country that you see such thing not manifesting, that you also not see economic progress. As I said earlier, Rwanda is a complicated story. Benevolent dictator or not, the economy is pretty much okay. But of course, you can never encourage the lack of periodic elections. And even if you have economic progress, if you retain a dictator in office for long, it's bound to eventually fail. I mean, that's just the reality of history. Even in the last, how many, two, 3 decades, we've seen the cases of countries like Zimbabwe, once a nice country, it was run to shambles because the president refused to go. Cote d'Ivoire was also almost going the same way. Senegal's Macky Sall, the president that was booted out of office recently, was almost going for a third term, and the economy was shaky because of that. And eventually, it got a little bit more stabilized when the democratic transition happened. So, it's It's a matter of, we cannot encourage authoritarian rule because we just think a benevolent dictator will stabilize the economy. It doesn't really work like that. But one other thing I was going to mention is, when I was mentioning, talking about direct investment, foreign direct investment the last time, I think FDI has to be rethinked on the continent. Again, I was driving through New Delhi yesterday and I couldn't stop marveling at seeing offices of Microsoft, some of the other more bigger corporation, IT corporations in New Delhi, in India generally. And it's not the same in majority of Africa. Maybe South Africa, maybe Kenya a little bit, but majority of sub-Saharan Africa, you don't really find that much strong investment by this massive international corporations, because again, majority of the international holdings in Africa, the FDI, are in resources and resource extraction. And it's not that resource extraction is the most evil, but the problem is that what we've seen recently is corporations like Apple haven't really paid attention to how the activities has promoted violence in the Democratic Republic of Congo. And we can't really use an iPhone today without what is coming out of the DRC. So if people are seeing the activities of Apple in the DRC, they will be criticizing FDI. That it's because you open your economy to this foreign competitions that they are actually promoting wars in our country. So again, it's a call for international corporations, not only to move away from resource extraction, but to actually go into tech investment in Africa, but also to pay attention to some of the activities and how it might be promoting some internal civil wars or crisis on part of the continent.
So I think one thing that we all do when we, and even in this talk, Africa is a continent, incredibly diverse continent,
yeah,
with very different local realities. And sometimes these subtle nuances get mixed in the picture. So if you could educate us a little bit about these subtle differences within the diversity of Africa and what kind of historical background you see where it is less likely to fall into dictatorship, you know, what kind of historical preference or historical context has led to that path, whereas what kind of historical context has led to more of, you know, strongman leadership? Because one of the problems with FDI is also into the kind of regime that it comes into. And if it comes into a regime that's already corrupt, it's more likely to be, you know, able to extract a lot more or exploit resources. Whereas in a democratic framework, perhaps, you know, the FDI that's coming in will also be held more accountable. So just in terms of those differences, are there nuances when we are completely missing when we discuss Africa as a continent, you know, not recognizing it's an incredibly diverse continent?
I'm so glad you brought up that question. You see, Abita, one of the things we really have to be very realistic with ourselves is not every foreign corporation coming to Africa has the good intent. Some of them, I mean, some actually maybe come with good intent, but some of the activities is not in the interest of Africans in some extent. And the reason why I say that is when you have corporations that are pretty much into cronyism or interested only in monopolizing sectors, they don't want competition, they don't even want local competitors. That is anti-market. You need competition both domestically and internationally to drive economic progress. And you already said it, corporations that do not have good intent, that want monopoly, they love to have authoritarians in the government. And that is the case in many of African countries. Even if we can't blame corporations to the fullest extent, the very African countries also have to share the blame. I mean, authoritarians love to have corporations that are only interested in monopoly. So it's a case of, when you have stable government, the parliament is working, the judiciary is working, it's hard for anyone coming in to monopolize sectors, key sectors. And the contrary also will give room for monopoly. And what we've seen is that key sectors on the continent have been monopolized for long. And there is this notion of I think I forgot the phrase they use, but it's called premature liberalization, that many African countries are not ready to liberalize because the local entrepreneurs are not strong enough to compete. For example, one of the most promising sectors on the continent is in tech. If you think tech, you might not want to think Africa first. So if we want to liberalize the tech sector, it means you're going to bring corporations that Microsoft, IBM, that strong, immensely big to compete with local competitors. And many people in Africa will say that as a no-brainer. Don't do it because it's not going to be fair. But again, we need this kind of competition. The conversation we need to be asking or having is, how do we prepare our local entrepreneurs to be ready? And there are several laws that are anti-business, several laws that hinder entrepreneurs. I mentioned about the protests in Kenya and Nigeria recently. Some of them are about that. How difficult is it for you to register business? How difficult is it for you to operate legally in Nigeria, making good money as a young person, before you know what you're going to get a knock on your door by the agency. I don't want to even mention it, but a state agency asking you about how you're making your money and whatnot. So if we are not encouraging young people to invest, to be tech entrepreneurs, to take risks, we cannot really blame corporations like IBM, Microsoft coming in and being the bigger player, because eventually local people will not be able to compete. So it's a matter of, we need this competition, right? But again, how to prepare our own local people to be ready for competition in agriculture, for competition in textile industry? Those are real conversations that unfortunately many people are not having on the continent.
I'd like to take the conversation back to this question about environment, which is a massive concern, obviously. And I just wanted to share with you an observation and wanted to hear your thoughts about that. In Indonesia, there's a rainforest and people are concerned about the deforestation and encroachment of humans in the natural habitat of wild animals. You have the same discussion in Brazil. And in a way, my observation is that in Africa, it seems Africa is slightly on a better track, because what Brazil or Indonesia seem to fail to do is to turn these rainforests into private properties that might be protected by people who use it for tourism, you know, who are allowed to actually exploit the fruits of this for the communities, the local communities. In Africa, it seems you have a better grasp on getting private initiatives into natural conservation efforts. But nevertheless, with such a demographic explosion and industrial growth that the continent needs, you will have a clash with the environment. So I'm just wondering, do you see Africa on the right track there with these private initiatives that are quite widespread, or what are you envisioning?
So I might not be totally correct, but I think I should be correct when I say majority, if not majority, a significant portion of the groups doing cleanups on the continent, doing plastic recycling, cleanup of the environment, are private corporations, are private organizations. Some NGOs, but several for profit. And these are young people. You just need to go on Instagram and look at recycling companies in Lagos. Majority of them, if not all, will be young people doing private stuff. So there's already that conversation going on, and young people are already exploiting that. But when it comes to climate change generally, we cannot run away from the fact that Africa is, I think, the least emitter in terms of continent. And we also seem to be the largest, or the number one, the one receiving the most detriment in terms of climate change. You just need to look at the Nile River, which is pretty much the lung of Northern Africa and Eastern Africa, stretching from Egypt to Uganda. It's scary to know that it's projected that about one third of it will be gone by the end of the century. Imagine if Nile is gone, or half or a quarter of it. It's a massive economic problem. I'm from Nigeria. Lake Chad is massive to the northern part of the country. It's pretty much drying up heavily. So it's a lot of reality of the going on the continent in terms of climate change. However, how organizations, or like the UN, I've been trying to address it on the continent, this is what I have a problem with. Certainly, fossil fuel has to be phased out. But how do we do that is the question. There was a call in 2021 by COP26 for Africa to embrace some unimaginable reforms that would pretty much kill the economy of the continent. You are asking people to stop using cooking gas or kerosene. See, we grew up having our parents use kerosene to cook. Eventually, when we went to undergrad, they start using gas cooking to cook, right? And I can recall how you go to buy breakfast. Back in the day, sometimes you want to buy bean cake. You go into this small hut where a middle-aged or old woman is frying bean cake using firewood. You want to buy local delicacies. People love it when it's cooked on firewood. And many of our cities still use firewood to cook. But the problem is that that is detrimental to health, right? So if you're asking people to stop using cooking gas, you're asking them to stop using kerosene, which they've been trying to move to because firewood, of course, is not healthy. If you're asking them to leave that, what are they going to go back to? Firewood. So as much as you think you want to cancel cooking gas and kerosene, you encourage them to go into an option that will be frying their lungs, basically. But again, so the question is, how do we help the continent gradually shift from fossil fuel to renewable energy? I spent a significant time in Lagos and in Ibadan. These are two massive cities in West Africa. And I was stunned to see the number of solar panels. You know where the solar panels come from? Private companies, private locally owned companies. These are not companies that got money from the government to start their own businesses. So people are already finding solutions to their own problem, trying to move away. But you just do not need to force them to do it on a cold turkey strategy. There has to be gradual phasing now. So I think that's one of the things part of the conversation that we are missing on the continent. Africa is not as ready as the US to shift from not using kerosene or cooking gas to now using windmills, or America already has that strength. Japan has it, Korea has it, Germany has it. Even India has that capacity. Majority of our continent countries in Africa do not have that capacity yet. So it's like you're asking everybody to run a 100-meter race at the same time where one of them pretty much doesn't have a shoe. So it's a matter of facing reality, pretty much.
I think that's a very fascinating take overall, and I very much believe in that line of these international commitments on when a country is actually ready to take on that kind of a commitment, which gets less recognized in the environmental movement. But let's move on to now discussing a little bit about the potential of Africa with this population dividend, a little bit into positiveness of what other sectors, right? So you mentioned fintech. Let's explore that a little bit. Digitization and fintech is really shaping African economic landscape, right? How do you think that is going to play in terms of the global competitiveness? Like, can Africa compete in the fintech sector? Can African companies now provide fintech solutions to the rest of the world? Is it at that stage yet? How do you see that developing?
Yeah, so you see, fintech is, as I say, it's revolutionizing trade on the continent, more so among Africans themselves. Not because a lot of young people are finding employment in that, not only because this is an industry pretty much heavily funded by personal savings or angel investors, not by some government loan that you cannot even get, but also because it's making integrated transaction within Africa so efficient. There is this new big trade agreement called the African Continental Free Trade Area, which is pretty much the hugest, if I can use that English, the biggest free trade agreement on the continent. That's pretty much trying to achieve about 90% tariff liberalization, integrate the continent more, reduce border tariffs, like pretty much open borders within Africa. Can you imagine how if you cannot import rice from Benin Republic to Nigeria? This is like New Delhi and Uttar Pradesh pretty much beside each other. But again, you can pretty much conveniently import rice. Part of the things that agreement is trying to get at is to open the borders pretty much for economic transactions within Africa among African entrepreneurs, right? Now, part of the challenge we have in implementing or actualizing that agreement or the AFCFTA is you cannot pretty much talk about integration of trade in the 21st century without the fintech sector, right? So again, you cannot have government creates 100 fintech companies at the same time. Even if they create one, it cannot work efficiently. Just look at electricity in Nigeria and you'll agree. So where do we then get those digital integration of currencies or fintech that will allow people to trade easily between Nigeria and Ghana without actually using paper money? That's where the fintech comes in. And what we've seen is that the conversation about the continent being ready for this trade agreement, the continent being ready for this inevitable so-called globalization, the continent being ready for the new wave of economic interest on the continent, that is being driven by individuals, being driven by young people, again, fintech. So if you are an entrepreneur selling shoes in the US and you want to get into the Nigerian market, nowadays you don't even have to engage significantly the local banks in the country. Just get into the fintech companies and you can easily move money around. And of course, Bitcoin is there. Many people are not as big of a fan of Bitcoin, but it's really also revolutionizing trade on the continent. So it's a matter of there have been challenges. Many of the challenges are not being addressed by the government. People are taking agency and initiative to address it themselves. A majority of those people taking the agency are young people. And it's we can only be hopeful that there will be less regulation in sectors like the fintech or agriculture that will allow young people, that will allow local entrepreneurs more so to flourish even more. So that this conversation about local entrepreneurs not being ready for corporations, not being ready for competition, premature liberalization, will we be put to bed? Even China, the so-called bastion of central planning, local entrepreneurs are pretty much strong in that country. So why would Africa's case be different?
So we really talk about the generational change. That's mm-hmm. what it boils down to, right?
Yeah.
When we think about, especially sub-Saharan Africa, we're talking about, at the moment, extraction of minerals and natural resources. That's large part. You mentioned Congo, you mentioned the cobalt mines, basically. Cocoa from West Africa, plantations, that is definitely something that Africa is known for at the moment, cotton production there. But with fintech, we're talking about small, medium-sized enterprises. We talk about very small enterprises, actually. We're talking about service sector. Is that the generational change that you're talking about?
1,000%. So majority of employments on the continent are tied to SMEs. They are tied to one-man businesses, right? And majority of those businesses are reliant on fintech to survive. They are reliant on using transactional applications to circumvent the traditional banking system, which is super complicated. You need more than 1 million documents to actually register a company account in Nigeria and all those crazy nonsense. But you mentioned cocoa, and it reminds me of one of the things I was going to say earlier. See, our business people, African business people, have always been allergic to government control of their activities. I'm talking about local entrepreneurs. One of the biggest cases that people don't often talk about happened in the 1930s, where there was this, you know, at 1930s, we were still under colonial rule, right? 1930s, cocoa was one of the major cash crops, as you want to call it, between West Africa and the rest of the world, right? And many of those transactions were driven by daddy and mummies, individuals who owned cocoa farm. Or to some extent, there were middlemen, African middlemen, that would bring cocoa from the interior into the port cities of Lagos and elsewhere in the Gold Coast or now in Ghana. And in the 1930s, there were moved by some corporations in Britain to have a centrally controlled cocoa pool. Can you imagine how the African traders reacted? They reacted in some of the most unbelievable way, through protest, through protests, through strikes, through immense pressure, that it's unimaginable that you're going to control the price of cocoa or have a centrally planned cocoa managing system. No, this is the way we want to trade it. This is the way we've been trading it for decades, and we want to continue. it's pretty much shut down the economy of the Gold Coast, which is now Ghana, in the 1930s. And that fever of protest against cocoa pool or centrally planned cocoa pricing stretched to West Africa. So people have always been allergic to that. They don't want you to impose prices on them as local entrepreneurs. They want to have open transactions, which is why, I mean, you just need to go into Lagos and you see young people. I mean, this is the reality because I not only were my different moms I had at my a different part of my life, always moved between Lagos to Benin Republic, across the borders to go and buy shoes to sell in the local market. They will tell you stories about how they bribe pretty much border patrol officers, and you calculate the amount they're paid in bribes. It's a huge chunk of the capital. But not only are those kind of economic agency manifesting among our people, but we do not simply like when there is no competition. And the one thing, as I said earlier, that the continent needs to move forward is to encourage competition, to make local entrepreneurs ready for competition, and to not stifle, like pretty much strangle local entrepreneurs. And they will always react, as we've seen recently in Kenya.
That's very fascinating, because normally we think of producers always coming together. Well, traditional orthodox economics tells us they will monopolize, form a cartel. But you're telling me actually there is this inherent African characteristics where local entrepreneurs have always resisted this kind of centralization, which gives a lot of hope to the future of Africa. Earlier you mentioned that Africa has this huge infrastructure gap, and over a period of the last decade, we've seen rising investment from China into infrastructure coming into Africa. What's your view on this?
Okay, so this is one of the most complicated things on the continent to answer. So, as I said earlier, the African Development Bank said we need to spend roughly 130 to 170 billion on infrastructure annually. The question we need to ask ourselves is, how much is Africa making collectively to invest in that? I think our export earning in terms of goods trade in 2023 or 2022 was about $380 billion. So if we are earning $380 billion from export earnings and we have to spend $170 billion annually, you're close to half of your money gone to infrastructure. The question is infrastructure our only problem? Absolutely not. So the reality is we need more money. I mean, it will be my dream come true if we can fix corruption, because we lose about $53 or $58 billion to corruption annually. So if that is closed, it means we have more money to. But of course, we're not going to fix corruption. It's our little baby. We love it. And the Western countries love to help us perpetuate the corruption. But the problem is that we are in a situation where we need as much help as we can get. And right now, that help is coming from China. Now, there is no inherent economic problem in you borrowing money. In fact, for you to make a successful business, 9 out of 10, you need to borrow, right? But it's the mode in which that borrowing is occurring. The average loan deal between an African country and China is secretive. You can never get the report. I challenge anybody to go find the last, if you can find half of the last trade, loan agreement between China and any African country, if you can find half of them in the last 1 year, you can't pretty much find it anyway, because they are secretive. You don't know how much your country is getting. I mean, sometimes you know, but sometimes you do not know how they're going to repay. When are they supposed to repay? And if you know one thing about the continent, is that dictators try to, not even only dictators, those that are elected through elections, they will take big money from China. For 8 years, they get out of power. The new government comes in, needs more money, because the last money the last regime took was embezzled. So they'll go to China again and get more money, and China will still give them more money. And it's like a cycle where you have more debt. And we've seen cases where China is actually going into the countries to seize national assets. So if for example, in Uganda, China went there to seize an airport, is it in Ghana or Zambia, one of those countries? The question is, when did China become the owner of the airport? Apparently, when they were signing the loan agreement, it was there that they can seize the airport if they default on loan. So if those loan processes are not transparent and China can easily take our national assets if we don't get to pay, then it becomes a problem. So again, it's a matter of loan being done differently, because majority of those loans are directly into infrastructure. They are not even, in many cases, going into the purse of the government. If you go to China and say you want a loan for a road from Mombasa to Lagos, they probably will tell you, okay, we're going to bring our company to build the road. We're not going to give you the cash. But the question is, if we don't pay, they can easily take back that road. So again, it's a matter of transparency. And people have, I mean, I'm also one of those people that think this is pretty much a Chinese approach to, I don't want to use the word colonize Africa, but also to, but pretty much to hold Africa by the strangle neck. They need military bases in many of those countries. They need they need to find employment for many of their population. They need to have many of their investments being overriding American investment or European investment in Africa. And the best ways to do that is when you have African leaders by the neck. So again, it's not bad to borrow. It's not a problem to borrow to finance infrastructure. But the problem is, it becomes a challenge if we don't know how much is being borrowed, if we don't know how it's going to be paid back, and if the intention behind it is pretty much not good.
And we can see that the Chinese government and their related enterprises are really active in Africa. So we see roads being built, we see ports being built, airports. Do you see already that this affects Africa? Or, I mean, does it change trade patterns? Do you see something emerging from this?
So, as I said, see, this is really complicated, because you cannot deny that this road built by China, the airports, the ports, the seaports, have tremendously transformed trade on the continent. Just go to East Africa. But the problem is that if you do not have the right to control that so-called railway station or railway network or that airport as an African country, because maybe COVID happened and you can't get the money to repay China, and you're scared that they're going to take that airport and seize it and start controlling it, then it's what use is it then on the long run? So again, as I said earlier, it's good that we moved away from that World Bank US loan systems where they give you the cash as a government, and the government will pretty much use the money crazily, and then they can pay back. We moved away from that in 2005, 2006 pretty much, to this kind of new loan in infrastructural development. But it's still also problematic. I guess what we need to do is then encourage China to be more transparent in terms of the details of those loans, and for it to give time to African countries to pay back, and for that payback mechanism to be feasible. I mean, if you know as China that a country like Nigeria has one of the most unbelievable corruption rates, and the transparency in the government in terms of accountability is almost zero, and that same government comes to you as China asking for, let's say, $200 billion. What do you need to do? Don't you need to ask the auditing of the last loan they get, or what is your financial anti-corruption agency doing? Or, I mean, give us your book. Let's see. You don't do that. All you do is just give them the money. That's so suspicious. So, again, we need those money for infrastructure, because without it, we can't pretty much be ready for the transformation that's going to happen on the continent. But again, infrastructure that eventually kills you is no infrastructure at all.
So basically, you agree with what development economists are predicting, that while the West, let's call it the West, IMF, World Bank, with their loans in infrastructure, they at one point ran into a dilemma of indebted countries that couldn't pay back. And then you have all these very difficult discussions about, you know, forgiving loans or debt restructuring, etc. So that's why, in a way, some Western donors have retracted from this practice. Now the Chinese have come in with almost the same, maybe on different terms or more secretive. But some development economists would say China will run into the same problem that they are going to face, that there is this mounting debts, the countries don't know how to pay that back, and you are in a very difficult international diplomatic dilemma, at least, you know, how to handle that. So you are basically agreeing, right, that China will run into the same problem.
I mean, they're already running into it. It's in Zambia, in Uganda. I'm very sure Nigeria is going to be next, because you look at that country, inflation is at unprecedented high rates. Even in Ghana, unbelievable economic realities occur in those countries. I don't see those countries being able to pay their Chinese or service their loan as they perhaps agreed to for the next foreseeable 2, 3, or 4, 5 years. But the thing is, when we talk about loans, again, as I said, it's inevitable. You have to borrow at some point. America borrows, even Germany borrows, right? But the point is that what can we do to make African countries being able to pay back? How can we help them have the strength to pay back? You just need to look at, for example, how much we are making from exports of natural resources. Nigeria, Libya, let's even forget about the Northern African countries, because they are even better than the majority of the sub-Saharan African countries. Let's focus on sub-Saharan Africa. Nigeria, Angola, these are two of the biggest exporters of petroleum, right? And you look at how much those countries are making from petroleum. It's massive. Why in the world can we not encourage those countries to be much more transparent in how they use their money? Why in the world would we, as the US, support regimes that we know that is corrupt, regimes that we know that will run the countries into ground? But because we need those regimes to build our military port, or because we are as the US, we need those regimes to be in power so that we can prevent Russia from coming in or whatever. And eventually what that creates is the money those countries are making will not be judiciously accounted for. And those are monies that they could be using to service their loans. But because the corruption is so endemic, transparency is almost zero, they wouldn't have the resources to service the loan. So if you're not encouraging a payback system or mechanism that will make sure those countries are ready to service the loan, as America or as Germany or as EU, as China, then you're going to run into a problem, as Reina observed, that they will not be able to pay. But the second thing I want to also emphasize is how that resource extraction needs to be rethought. As I said earlier, I don't know the numbers, but I'm very sure a huge chunk of the resources being extracted from Africa don't go through the normal chain. So you don't even know who was extracting or who is doing what or not. A majority of those extraction are not within the African continent. They are outside the African continent. And many of those companies in Europe, in the US, they report to their own governments, their activities, right? That we are Apple, we made this X amount of money. Why can't those Western governments question their own companies' activities on the continent of Africa? That are you getting those resources paid for properly? Because if you are not paying for your cobalt properly, you're not paying for the rubber or the cocoa you're getting from Africa properly, it means those African governments are not making proper money. And if they are not making enough money, how would they be able to pay the EU back or pay China back? So it's like a cycle or a kind of a dependency system where the ability of Africa to not take loan depends on the ability of Africa to have resources to sustain itself. And the ability of Africa to repay loans also is contingent upon the ability of Africa to be able to pay it. And all depending on Western countries encouraging transparency, encouraging responsibility of their own companies' activities on the continent. So it's pretty much complex.
You present a very interesting picture. It's almost the geopolitical situation. If you look at globally, the fighting ground is then the African continent at this moment of different interests coming together. Mm. But let's add to that this population pressure that you're facing. And young people vote with their feet to a large extent. They will go wherever there are economic opportunities. They will go where they find these economic opportunities. And already we're facing a huge migratory trend from Africa, going into other places, looking for these opportunities. As a person who comes from a country that heavily relies on remittance to the border of being, whether it's a Dutch disease case or not, is being debated. How much do you see as eventually if the geopolitical powers don't clean up their act, like you say, maybe demanding more transparency from their corporation, helping Africa in certain matters, what's going to happen to migration patterns eventually? What do you see that, how does this impact the migratory patterns?
So this is a two-sided question. The first one about geopolitics, then migration. See, the major superpowers on the continent, in the world, the US, China, Russia, they need cooperation. They need to have corporate or friendly governments in Africa. So it's a hotbed. The continent is a hotbed for geopolitical strategy. That's why you see the Wagner Group crazily going into the Sahel region and influencing regime change. That's what US used to do. Now it's the Wagner Group and Russia. And we now seen more debates about China constructing military bases across Eastern Africa, even in West Africa. That was a rumor last month in Nigeria. Is it last 3 months that China was trying to build? Is it China or the US? One of them was trying to build a new military base in the country. But the question is, we don't even care about the politics going on between the US and China. We don't. That's not our problem. And if that's not our problem, it means. But our leaders don't see it that way, because if they can court China or Russia, that's money to their own pocket, but it's not the interest of the people. So there is that geopolitical reality going on. It's always going to be the hotbed for strategic military locations and deployments of whatnot. But the other thing we need to look at is, you talk about migration, and I mean, I just have to say, if Europe is complaining about how so-called migration from the Mediterranean region or Mediterranean Sea is a problem, I'm sorry to say, but you guys haven't seen nothing. Because with the population of the continent exploding to 2.5 billion, the reasons why those people are leaving the continent, why do you think? Because of economic crisis, right? Political instability, terrorism, lack of opportunity. They can have their small businesses flourish. No jobs. You think those things are going to disappear before 2050? No, they even going to be more. But I mean, I hope not. But according to what we are seeing, the indications are unemployment is going to be even more crazy in places like Nigeria, Sudan, those countries that have massive unemployment rates. Lack of business opportunity will be even more. So again, I hate to sound pessimistic, but I guess the reality of statistics it ought to be an encouragement for us as Africans and our friends across the world to look at Africa with greater intentionality. Whatever policies we want to do, let's make sure we have been intentional. I'm not asking people to always consider Africa first or whatnot, but if you are going to have an agreement with Africa, just have in mind, would that trade agreement, would that military agreement keep Africans in Africa? Encourage them to see their hope in flourishing within their continent and not seeing the West as a greener pasture? Because if you're not doing that, which pretty much creating chaos for yourself, and people, it's normal, people always migrate. They will always emigrate from their country to find bigger opportunities. You can't really prevent them. So again, the migration thing is, it would not reduce if opportunities for economic prosperity or businesses or safety is not addressed on the continent.
So if you were able to address relevant decision makers in the West, what would you suggest? I mean, kindly separate between the governments and the private sector. Mm. We have talked now about China quite a bit, but let's talk about Europe and maybe the US as well. In Europe, the concern is, if we do request transparency in the supply chains, then this comes with recording requirements, then this means we have to withdraw from certain countries that will not collaborate in the transparency. And the concern is European companies would lose their competitiveness, they will lose to the Chinese ones, in economic terms, as an adverse selection. So the ones who don't care take over the market. And so the question really is, how can the West, I hate that term, but how can Europe and the United States really engage constructively in Africa? One is the development aid path and the other one is the private sector path.
You are spot on where you mentioned development aid, but I mean, I think people, I don't want to say the settled debates, but there have been many literature that have shown that foreign aid is not, it hasn't really helped the continent do anything. You look at the countries that have received the most foreign aid in Africa, you can't convince me that they have been the most developed. It's just a cycle that you just keep giving money and giving money. In many cases, those foreign aid, I'm not talking about the humanitarian aid. I'm not talking about, say, that it's farming. I'm talking about foreign aid. It's been making local entrepreneurs becoming less competitive. It's making governments be more corrupt and whatnot. And why do you think Africa needs your money to address its own problem when we can fix corruption, when we can be much more transparent and look at our own natural resources to generate money like the EU, like America does, being responsible. But I love the way you divide this conversation into two, the one that addresses the private sector and the second addressing the government. Because those two cadres actually have specific things they need to pay attention to. I think with the private sector, as I said earlier, responsibleness is very key. You cannot think it will be easy for advocates to go into the Democratic Republic of Congo or Ghana and say, we need more private sector investment. They will tell you, well, you just need to look at Galamsey, or there's a illegal mining in Kenya, as or in Ghana. It's called Galamsey, and it's pretty much destroying the environment there. You look at the DRC, the non-stop war is fostered by lack of responsibility, by cooperation. It's not easy for us to go into those countries and ask for more liberalization because they'll tell, well, look at this. So private sectors or private corporations need to be much more responsible. And as I said earlier, the investment just has to shift. We can't keep tying FDI to resource extraction. It's also need to be in fintech. It's also need to be in several other industries other than extraction. Because you can tell me there aren't as smart as many people in Kenya and Nigeria as you have in India, or as big potential for engineering innovations in South Africa and Botswana as you have in China. But again, there is always the need to shift from resource extraction. The message for the government is that I think, just to put it straight, EU governments, the US or Northern American government, needs to stop encouraging dictators in Africa. As I said earlier, no, it's no more geopolitical ABC. Governments, bigger governments, need to have political stooge power in the lesser strong countries for them to keep exploiting or to keep having influence. If America is concerned that China could go into Nigeria, the biggest populous country in Africa, and, you know, have influence, then America will have to do everything to make sure the Nigerian government is under its own pillow, even if the Nigerian government says it's not conducting an election. So, but the point here is that we also need to be very realistic. You cannot eat your cake and you cannot have your cake and eat it. You cannot want to protect your own interests in Africa, and also at the same time, making sure dictators are well fed, making sure they win the next election, making sure those that are actually supposed to come into power are not coming to power. The CIA have done that for many years, and now other countries are also in Europe and North America are also doing that. So the other thing is the financial part of it. We of course know that sending hundreds of millions of dollars is not going to help many African countries are there address their problem. So the necessity then is the finance. And one thing relating to that, it concerns, I don't know if you guys have followed recently this wave of military regime ascendancy across what is considered the Sahel, Niger, Burkina Faso and all that. Those are majority, if not all, former French colonies, right? And one of the reasons why that has been happening, not only happening, but you go into those countries, people are always jubilating that the military take over power. In Nigeria recently, the protests I mentioned last month, there were Russian flags on the streets of Nigeria. People wishing Russia can... But the thing is that France, for example, has held those African countries by the neck for decades. They control their central banks, they control their financial life and whatnot. So that when Russia came in, the Wagner Group came in to inspire military coup, people were forced, they were like ready to have military regime because they knew the reality of France's activities in those countries. And now the military is in power in many of those countries. They're even trying to form their own parallel organization to the African Union. Trust me, they have the power to do that. Is it gonna benefit us or exist in the long run? Maybe not, but they have the power to do that. So the point I'm trying to drive at is that European countries also need to be very conscious of their acts on the continent, not only in knowing the kind of government they support. It's not only about the kind of foreign aid they give, but also looking at how their relation with the continent over the years, aspect of it that is not favoring the continent. You cannot control the central bank of an African country and you think that African country will have the right to exist and steer its own economic reality. I mean, this is 2024. I can't imagine we're still having that kind of conversation.
I can't imagine that too. Thank you, Babatunde. This is a fantastic conversation overall. I think it is enlightening in the sense of how do we look at what's happening in the African continent, but also, like you said, the intentionality we need to look at things within Africa as a global community of liberals trying to promote things. So thank you very much for a very, very wonderful discussion. I had a fantastic time.
I'd like to add to that because, yes, it was very inspiring listening to you. Africa, I believe, also is struggling with this terrible reputation. It's a sad branding for famines and crises, etc. But you brought it down to real life issues of stability, investment, trade, you know, livelihoods of people, as we have all over the world. So it's very enlightening speaking to you. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Gilles.
So that was a really, really interesting conversation and enlightening to me to a large extent, Rainer, because often when we think about the African continent, like you said, the narrative has been said more in terms of the aid dialogue, which is it is hunger, famine, and so on and so forth. But today's interesting conversation with Babatunde put forward, you know, this incredible sure population dividend that they could potentially use as an opportunity. But he rightly points out that the African continent really needs to get its act together in terms of being prepared to reap the benefits out of this population dividend. And so there needs to be this larger investments in things like infrastructure, things like health and education, so that they can invite the correct kind of investments that are transparent. But at the same time, it's also, I think what made me really hopeful in the conversation was this movement from young people pushing towards more transparency. So yes, the African continent needs to get ready, but there is a move from within Africa that is saying we need to be more transparent. We need to know what kind of investments we are bringing in. We need to know, you know, how these investments are being spent. So I think that actually gave me kind of a big hope in things moving in the right direction in the African continent.
Yeah, that's also, I took this also away from this conversation. It gives you hope that this continent is really just gaining the confidence to stand up for itself, which of course it absolutely can do. But then I also thought he gave us a word of caution that there should not be unrealistic expectations. And there were a few. He mentioned the premature liberalization, and that is something we've seen in other continents as well, but also in Africa, where if you just push it to the private sector, if you just say, okay, let's privatize, this might go to cronies, this goes even to Western companies that work with corrupt governments. So just to say the private sector will do it is not necessarily a good idea, because what we kind of assume when we say private sector in other countries, we would say there would be competition. The private sector has to be innovative, creative, and survive in the competition with others. But in some countries, this is not the case. So they are able to actually establish a close relationship with the government, what economists would call regulatory capture, when the private sector basically works in cahoots with the government. And that can have really negative effects. And this we see in countries in Africa where this is playing out very badly. And in a way, his words of caution in this regard would also go to those who would demand maybe unrealistic expectations in terms of climate change and in terms of conservation of the nature, etc. So things have to be done in small steps. Africa needs to develop, and that needs to come to a new compromise between natural habitat and human habitat. And so we will see this as a very difficult process in the future.
True, but I think also one of the things is what Babatunde really emphasized is there is local knowledge. It is the young people in Africa who are bringing in these environmental solutions to the forefront in private capacity without any government support. So whatever entrepreneurship we are seeing that's coming out of Africa really is being driven by these very, very innovative young people who are coming out with, like, whether it's fintech or in conservation or in recycling, things like that. So that's a really positive message of hope. So in that sense, I think one of the key takeaways for me was the kind of investments that the West is trying to make within Africa. I really liked his message to Western governments about intentionality. You really need to think of who you are investing in within Africa. Are you supporting a regime that is undemocratic, that is authoritarian because of your larger geopolitical agenda, whatever it is? And so if you really think about, the question he put forward, are you actually investing in Africa in a way that is going to keep Africans within the African continent, or do you actually want them to move? So this is a very interesting question, especially in the migration debate that's happening right now. I really see this as a key takeaway of what kind of investments the international community is making within Africa. It needs to go with that intentionality. We need to understand African local realities and also look at the long-term implications of those investments.
And he had the same message to Chinese investors, because he was saying they are very intransparent. They never disclose, but quite often they don't disclose the terms of the contracts that they have with the governments in Africa. So this kind of secretive behavior obviously gives rise to suspicions that there is corruption involved. We're worried that they would have contract clauses that say they can take over the infrastructure if the government is not able to pay back the debt. So the Chinese themselves might run into problems at one point when the countries are defaulting on all these loans. And so what I liked was Apita, when he said, shouldn't we work so that these countries are actually able to pay back those loans? Shouldn't we, empower them and enable them to pay by having a strong industrial base, by having a strong economy by themselves, and not just receiving loans and then they have no idea to pay back?
Yeah, very great point in general. So, I think it was a very, very interesting conversation and a timely conversation. I think one of the things that I'd like to further explore in further unleashing African, development paradigm is to also now examining the subtle nuances of what works within African continent. And I think we didn't have enough time today to take on that topic, but it's definitely a topic for further discussion in general.
Absolutely, because if not, and he put it really on the spot there when he said, Europe, you haven't seen anything yet. If you think you have a migration crisis, it's yet to come. If Africa goes from 1.5 billion to 2.5 or even 4.5 billion people, wait, what's happening if this continent is not up on its feet?
True. And with that stark warning, thank you very much for listening to us today on the podcast. We hope you join other fascinating conversations at the IIF podcast. Thank you for joining us today. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.